Reformed Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for this show. And listen to this. I discovered the sound effects on Riverside. Unfortunately, most of them are annoying, so I will not indulge myself too much anyway. I'm C.R. Wiley, and I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest, and I've done a number of things, including write books. Enough about me. How about you, Tom?
I'm Tom Price. I teach theology, Christian ethics, apologetics, and other things. One of the places is Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
All right. And Glenn, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and then introduce the subject of the day, because it's your day.
Okay. I'm Glenn Sunshine. I am contractually obligated to say I am a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and a ministry associate at Reflections Ministries. I'm also a retired history professor, which is going to be coming into the conversation today. And I have my own ministry called Every Square Inch Ministries. And that's enough to keep me out of trouble, usually. I thought it would be interesting today to talk about what causes nations and civilizations to collapse. I've identified a few things myself in my studies of history, and I've read some other people who have other components to it, and I've identified at least four of these. I have no idea how many we'll get through. But let's start with one that's relatively simple. Let's take a look at the Roman Empire. Great civilization, lasted for 1,000 years or more, when you include the Republic at least. And then, at least in the West, it completely collapses somewhere in the late 5th century. It continues in the East in Constantinople until 1453, but under really different circumstances over there. Yeah. So what is it that causes the Roman Empire to collapse? There are a lot of factors here, but I would focus on two of them. To get to the first of these, we have to start talking about climate history. The Roman Empire was the classical period was an unusually warm period in human history. It was actually warmer than the medieval warm period, which is warmer than what we've got now.
And we survived.
Yeah. And if you have any questions about that, consider the fact that the Vikings farmed in Greenland and they grew grapes in Norway. Yeah. Okay, enough said. But somewhere around the 3rd century or so, the climate began to shift, getting colder and wetter. Part of this actually was caused by a volcanic eruption in Iceland, but it was also just simply, climate shifts. It moves up and down. And when that happened, it meant the growing season in the north got shorter, making it harder or impossible to grow crops. So people like the Goths, who originated in Sweden, start moving south looking for warmer climates. They end up pushing other tribes, and then you have the Huns coming in from the east who are jostling other tribes and all that. But you have this period that in German history is called the Volkswanderung, the migration of peoples, roughly. And what happens is, for centuries, the Romans had been touting all the great benefits of Roman civilization. It's stable, it's economically prosperous, all of these kinds of things. And so a lot of these people who were being jostled decided, hey, you know what? We should go to Rome. So they will be able to take care of us.
Yeah, the advertising worked, but not in the way that they anticipated.
Right. Yeah, and originally it was family groups, clans, things like that. But then with the threat of the Huns, they invited the entire tribe of the Visigoths to take a chunk of territory on their border and rule that under theoretically Roman authority. The basic idea here is we will get our own pet barbarians to protect us from the other barbarians.
It's kind of like pit bulls or something like that.
Quick question, Glenn. What would be the size of the Visigoths at this time in terms of in terms of people moving? And I mean, do we have any way of being able to calculate
that? I've never seen a number, but it is a large number of people. And eventually, of course, they realized that Rome needed them more than they needed Rome. There are a bunch of wars, Alaric sacks, sacks Rome. Then they move from Illyricum, where they were originally, across into southern France. They cross over, they take over Spain, and so on. Okay. But you have a whole lot of these kinds of things happening. It's not just the Visigoths. You got the Ostrogoths a little bit later. You have the Vandals. You have the Franks. You have all of these different people who are moving in. And we talk about this frequently as barbarian invasions. And in some cases, you can actually call them invasions. But in most cases, it's an invasion by invitation.
Right.
They were welcomed in. And as you get this migration of all of these people, it changes the culture on the ground in a lot of ways within the empire. And when you add on top of that an ineffective and corrupt government and a Roman society that, frankly, was not we'll get back to this one later, but they were not seriously committed to doing what it would take to defend the empire, to defend Roman values and virtues and things like that, even to the point of not really having many children. When you look at all of this, the combination of mass migration and weakness and corruption at the level of the government causes not just the empire to collapse. We're not just talking politics here, but we're talking Roman civilization. The whole thing comes crashing down.
Yeah, this is
and then out of the interaction of what's the remnants of that and Germanic tribes, you have the you have the development ultimately of medieval culture.
Yeah, so this is all, of course, eerily sort of familiar. And you know, you remember that thing that went around maybe a month or two ago about women asking their husbands how many times a day they think of the Roman Empire?
Yes.
And they were stunned to see that just about all of their husbands actually think about the Roman Empire every day, if not multiple times a day.
I've been thinking about it a lot today, too.
Yeah, I said, that's me. I think about the empire every day. It's seared itself into our collective memory in a remarkable way. But I think when we think about the empire, we think about its halcyon days and maybe, you know, the first century BC, the first century AD. We don't, you know, the period that, you know, we're familiar with because of the New Testament.
Yeah.
Or into the second century. Third century begins to fall apart. But the second century was still part of the, you know, sort of the golden days. I think one of the reasons that men tend to think about the empire is when we think about the empire, I suspect that we're thinking about things like the Roman legions.
Right.
We're thinking about, you know, courage and virility and stoicism and endurance and all of these kind of masculine, traditionally masculine virtues, which I think for many of us, we sort of see as kind of the best of the Roman Empire. We recognize the corruption, but this was Rome at its best. And I suspect that is, on at least a subconscious level, what some of the attraction is for men.
Yeah, I think you're right. Another thing that's, and I've mentioned this before, is that when you look at the New Testament and you see Roman centurions in action, they're all good guys. I think, if I remember correctly, there's maybe five or seven centurions mentioned in the New Testament between the Gospels and Acts. And every single one of them pretty much is a principled fellow.
Mm-hmm. Well, Julius Caesar, you know, there were higher officers called tribunes in the military. And Caesar said something at one point that he'd rather lose five tribunes to one centurion. You know, because these guys were the backbone of the Roman army.
Yeah. Do you remember when Paul had, you know, been brought before the tribune in Acts? It's the centurion who steps in and saves Paul from being flogged, whipped, when he discovers that Paul was a citizen, which has always brought raised the question in my mind: how would you validate that? In other words, anybody could say, I'm a citizen. Why was it that the centurion believed him? I don't have anything to go with. I just have a suspicion that there was some way to know.
Well, yeah, I've wondered about that too, but I suspect part of the reason is if you claim to be a citizen and you're not, things go very, very badly for you.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
I suspect that that's part of it. You know, you don't make that claim lightly.
Right.
But again, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
my suspicion is that Paul would be able to document that he came from Tarsus, and people born in Tarsus were granted Roman citizenship sort of automatically.
Right.
Hence, I was born a citizen.
Right.
So, okay, so mass migration combined with a corrupt, ineffective government and sort of weak culture would be the first thing that, in the case of Rome, really brings down the empire seriously. Another thing that's worth mentioning at this point has to do with the fact that a lot of the Romans were pretty much antinatal. And this goes all the way back to Augustus. Augustus actually passed a law at one point mandating that Roman nobles had to get married and have children because they weren't doing it. Now, it was an oversexed culture. There was all kinds of sexual activity going on, but not a lot of marriage and procreation within
Another
the family.
Thing that's eerily familiar.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the things that the Christians really opposed.
Right.
They opposed the sexual laxity of the culture. They adamantly promoted the idea of marriage and children. And they valued children in a way that Roman culture didn't. Yeah. The typical Roman family in the heyday of the empire would keep all of their healthy boys and one healthy daughter, and the rest of them they would, quote, discard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which meant either flat out infanticide or leaving them out in the countryside where they will either die of exposure, wild animals, or someone will pick them up and raise them as a slave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see that piece that was in First Things not too long ago? It was by a woman who wasn't, I don't think she's even a believer, but she was reflecting upon Diggs in the United Kingdom of brothels, Roman brothels, mm-hmm. and the reverse was the phenomenon there. So when a prostitute bore a child, if it was male, it would be abandoned, and if female, it would be raised, obviously, so she could be another prostitute.
Yeah.
Right.
But they found these, you know, piles of bones, and they were able to determine they were male.
Well, you know, that's actually one of the things archaeologists working on classical sites know. They can always identify brothels and bathhouses because they find the bones of infants under them.
Right. Yeah.
There was actually a well in Athens that they excavated where they found over 200 dead children, dead babies.
Yeah, that's why I remember my first time going to Rome, doing the catacombs, and, you know, first time going to Italy and then doing the catacombs. I remember that being one of the first striking things that you see as you go down is all the little burials that Christians gave to the abandoned corpses of infants and children that were left to die. There was an actual radically different understanding of the dignity of image bearers of God. And it's amazing to see that striking contrast in a place such as that. It's really compelling.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the oversexed, the antinatalism is only part of this. The sort of oversexed thing is another. And that's actually the one that is particularly interesting. Back in the 1930s, there was an English sociologist by the name of Unwin who believed that family structure and sexual mores had nothing to do with the survival of a civilization or a culture. And he went out to prove this. And he was honest enough to say, I was wrong.
Yeah.
The evidence indicates that the only way, you know, he was dealing with what he called savage cultures. We would describe them maybe, well, it's hard to come up with a politically correct term for them today. Primitive, tribal, you know, cultures at a low level of social organization. Okay. The only way these societies emerge and develop and advance is if they put in restrictions on sexual activity. And specifically, connected to marriage. On a Freudian level, what this allows you to do, and this is what Freud talked about in Civilization and Its Discontents, it allows you to sublimate the energy that comes from your sex drive into productive activities to create civilization. Unwin didn't want to prove that, but functionally he said, yeah, you know, that's it. The other thing is, as you know, as is frequently discussed here, the way in which a society flourishes ultimately has to do with men buckling down and doing their responsibilities. And the only way that happens is if they're married and have children that they need to provide for and take care of. This is observationally true. It's also observationally true that this is what builds culture. Now, the interesting thing here is that what Unwin found is that this is what will allow a civilization to advance or culture to advance. But he said that if you are in this situation where you have these as a set of norms, if these norms are abandoned, if you loosen the strictures on sexual behavior, what ends up happening is it begins a process of decay in society. And he said there is no, he studied something like 30 different societies, and he said there is no exception to this. Once a society gives up on restrictions of sexual behavior within the context of marriage, once it gives up on that, if it gives up on it for three generations, there is no exception that society collapses.
Yeah, I'd like to think a little bit about this in a sort of broader way. I have been fascinated here recently by some things that a fella named Rob Henderson has written about luxury beliefs. He's got a new book out entitled Troubled, and it's about a very troubled childhood. He was raised in foster care, abandoned by his parents when he was like 3 years old, and had a lot of, you know, trouble in school and so forth. Eventually went into the Air Force. It was one of the things that's interesting. He's half Hispanic, half Korean. His mother was a drug addict. His father just abandoned him. But he was raised in very poor white communities because he was adopted eventually by a blue collar white family in a very, you know, impoverished county in California. But he eventually went on to Yale and then to Cambridge, where he got his PhD. And he noticed that that the elite who, you know, populate those institutions are hypocrites. Now, we all know they are, but in an odd way. He said they say things that are politically correct, but then they don't do them.
Yeah.
So, in other words, they'll say things like, you know, traditional marriage is moribund and is
oppressive to women, patriarchal, etc.
All this kind of stuff. But then they do it. You know, they get married, they stay married. Generally speaking, dad is the provider, all the stuff that, you know, they say. But what ends up happening is according to Henderson, is this is actually a luxury belief. In other words, something that you can wear kind of like, an accessory that you just, you know, put on, but you don't actually live according to the things you say. But the people who are taking it to heart and actually living the way you're describing are suffering. In other words, the costs are being borne by poorer people. So, which brings back the idea, an old idea that I think, you know, even in the United States, our aristocrats really believed in, and that is you have to keep up appearances for the sake of the culture. So, even though you might have doubts about this or that thing, you still go to church, you still, you know, support the institutions that, you know, sort of keep the community stable, not necessarily because you have to, because you could probably afford to be, a profligate. You've got, you know, the connections and the money and all that kind of stuff, but you do it for the sake of the people who don't have those things.
Yeah, noblesse oblige, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Except what we've got now is not that. What we have now are people who practice, in essence, pretty traditional ways of living, but for the sake of appearances, are advocating right. things that are totally different. Yeah. And that is, and what happens then is, well, with the sexual revolution, we have a radically different way of understanding sexuality than was traditionally the case. And the effect of this is, you know, when you look at rates of marriage, when you look at rates of out-of-wedlock births, when you look at, well, the overwhelming prevalence of pornography, all kinds of things like this, the lionizing of people who are living as, quote, sexual minorities, all of these kinds of things, this is what's dominant in the culture. Whether the elites are doing it or not, this is, in fact, what's dominant in the culture. But Unwin's analysis is correct, we are in probably the last generation that we've got before to turn this around, or we're going to, you know, we're going to see civilizational collapse.
It was definitely a sinister turn when, you know, we've talked about it enough, with a shift of emphasis from behaviors that are kind of what classically would seen as problematic sexually, to a kind of acceptance, to the way it shifts into this notion of identity, where it becomes then an attack on the person and the individual and their character and their kind of unique contribution to humanity, if you will, rather than an emphasis on behavior that goes against kind of the created procreative order, what we're endowed with in order to continue. And that kind of move becomes institutional. That's why we have, I mean, I can go down streets in West Hartford, there's, you know, rainbow flags everywhere, that, you know, all the, it is all an emphasis on that as an identity, and an identity that now is to be centralized as representing what healthy social sexuality acceptance is.
Well, here's something I'd like to just sort of bring up related to that. I don't recall ever hearing anybody say that this was socially healthy. I've heard people say that this is healthy for the people that are the sexual minorities. In other words, I don't hear anybody saying we need to have more of this. But that's, I guess my point is that we don't even care about social effects anymore.
Right.
We're at a point where the idea that we need to promote stable monogamy, monogamous marriages between men and women, and for the sakes of their children, is no longer a very, I think, broadly accepted belief.
Well, this is definitely a shift, though, from, this is kind of, I guess, what I was after. It's a little a shift within kind of the mentality of modernity itself, because I mean, if you think of some of the big shifts with Hobbes and some of the other leading figures in the Enlightenment, one of the things, I think it was either Bacon or Hobbes says specifically, is they want to basically change the human condition, basically from the start. So prior cultures emphasize the fact that the human condition is that from which you act, right? But they want to change the human condition. And some of the analysis you see in Montesquieu and others is where they're trying to wrestle with, we don't want the old Roman emphasis on trying to live on by fame and glory, right? Having a kind of pseudo immortality. Nor do we want to accept the Christian notion that we're basically going to be deified and live in eternity. Well, we want something that is more down to earth. And we want to focus on how is it that we can change the condition of the human to basically, they're not going to be immortal, but maybe we can extend their mortality, right? So the focus becomes on all their immediate needs at which the state is going to basically supply so they can continue and function and basically extend their health, which is a big shift you start to see from the old Roman virtues of glory and fame to now it's all about the sustenance of my health. But here is something where it isn't about health, right? So this is an emphasis that is definitely going the other direction. And this is what I mean when identity starts to take the shift here. the emphasis clearly can't be on the health of the individual or the society. It is kind of abandoning one of the principles of the Enlightenment. And of course, postmoderns want to do that. But I don't know if the initial thinkers were even, I mean, something shifted in the ethical system of modernity in its core emphasis.
Oh, sure. It's just think about somebody like Kant, you know, with the categorical imperative, you know. The maxim of your action should be, thought of as a universal law. If you can think in those terms, if the category universal can be applied to what you're talking about, then it's a sound moral principle. There's none of that here. Or if there is, it's only that kind of like a live and let live kind of thing. If you honor my, wanting to be a furry, I'll honor your wanting to be polyamorous or whatever. Yeah. But there's no appreciation or consideration for the health of the community as a community in terms of its, I would say, intergenerationally. I think that's key, the intergenerational part of it.
Yeah.
Right. And that, I think, is an important element as well. I'm going to shift a little bit here to kind of the next one. And this is going back to the Enlightenment too, but I'm going to take it in a bit of a different direction. In France, which is really the heart of the Enlightenment and really particularly the radical Enlightenment, France was the intellectual center of the world in this period. They've never gotten over that. All scholarly work it replaced Latin as the language of scholarship, the language of diplomacy, all of those kinds of things. So the French Enlightenment is really important. But one of the things you see in the French Enlightenment is a group of people known as philosophes. It's the French word means philosopher. These guys weren't philosophers. What they were social critics. And they had a big emphasis on reason. They were big, actually, interestingly enough, they were big on free markets, to use modern terminology here, because that was connected to their minds with liberty. So there are a lot of things that they're doing. But the social context in which the Enlightenment takes place is in salons. These are gatherings of people in some wealthy person's house. And at the salon, it brought together sort of the movers and shakers in society with these philosophes, these social critics. And the one rule in the salon is you could not be boring. You needed to be witty.
Right.
And the more witty you were, the more likely you were to be invited back.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. It's easy. Think John Stewart. It's easier to be witty and funny when you're criticizing things than when you're offering solutions.
Right.
So the philosophes actually some of these guys are really funny, but they developed a keen sense of humor, keen approach that was all based on satire and mocking the existing institutions in society. A premier example of this is Voltaire. Mm-hmm. If you read Candide by Voltaire, it's a great example of this. He actually reminds me a little bit of a line from Tom Lehrer. In a thing called The Hunting Song, Lehrer says, he's talking about how he had a tremendous haul when he went out hunting. It was 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. And the verse says, people ask me how I do it, and I say there's nothing to it. You just stand there looking cute, and when something moves, you shoot. And in a lot of ways, that's the way Voltaire operated. If anything moved in society, he mocked it.
Right.
And this could range from anything from monarchies to ethnicities, countries, every religious order in the Catholic Church, Protestants, whatever, all the way down to a critic who didn't like one of his plays. He shows up being mocked and candied. There's sort of a pettiness there. But there's this, Voltaire has this really radical critique of every aspect of French society. He gets in trouble. He spends some time in Bastille. He's sent into exile. He spends a lot of time in voluntary exile. And toward the end of his life, he was living in southern France, and he wrote a new play, and it was going to premiere in Paris. So after being away for decades, he returned to Paris for the premiere of this play. And when he got there, he was treated as a cultural hero, as a real celebrity. And when you think about that, this is about a decade, a little more than a decade before the revolution kicks off. And my assessment of that situation, and this is me, I haven't seen this in other French historians, but my assessment of that is that once French society accepts Voltaire as a cultural hero, the revolution is inevitable.
Yeah.
Because what it says is they've internalized the radical critique of all aspects of French society, and thus the revolution has to come. Something's got to give. The exact form of it is still up for grabs. But once they've internalized this utter rejection of everything about their society, you're going to get the revolution.
Related to this is the fact that it's much harder to build than to tear down.
Right.
Anybody that's attempted to build anything physically knows this. I can tear down something a lot quicker than I can put it up. One reason is gravity. You know, it's like when you're constructing something, you're having to do it in such a way so as that the structure actually defies gravity. But all you need to do is compromise a structure a little bit and it just collapses on its own. And I think that that's the case with institutions as well, not just physical structures, but intellectual, social structures, these kinds of things. And then you're going to be a more serious person, which means you're not as witty at the gathering. You know, if you're the sort of person who thinks, I need to support the institutions of my society and defend them, well, you're going to have a kind of serious demeanor and even maybe a pugnacious spirit when you see things threatened that rise to the defense of something. And so, you know, people who are just wanting to keep things light, think of you as a downer.
Yeah. Well, and I think you have this kind of, this is especially so, you know, I'm not saying it didn't happen to other peers, but especially with the Enlightenment, where sort of, everyone's capacity or everyone should have the capacity to be critical of things and evaluate them and try to critique. And because of that, people, I mean, you know, I think of just growing up, you know, in the U.S., you know, all the stuff from the Vietnam War and all the hangover stuff. And you're kind of thrown in this situation where if you appreciate anything of your culture, you are kind of castigated by those who think it has to be torn down all the way. Or they label you as someone who doesn't think that there are aspects of your culture that need reforming or renewal or perfecting, for that matter, in a healthy sense of the word. So as a Christian, I'm always going to have aspects of my culture that I don't think are healthy or good, and you know, to bring Christian light on that and the like. But I also recognize as a Christian that, you know, the cities of man, of which anyone we tear down and try to build another, are still built in Cain's fratricide. In other words, we can't undo that condition. Right. And so because of that, the only way to actually genuinely have a city that isn't going to have some problem whatsoever has to be found on a completely new foundation. And that, of course, is what the church is all about. And even that has to work within the mixed conditions of time itself.
I like to think a little bit, too, about those intellectuals that preceded Voltaire. A couple come to mind, and they all had this sort of snide, jaundiced eye. You know, you think about like Montaigne, mm-hmm. you know, or you think about La Rochefoucauld. Now, La Rochefoucauld was hilarious if you've ever read his Maxims. but these are guys, I mean, so this is part of the French intellectual tradition. It's interesting to see how Pascal, another Frenchman, responded to Montaigne. He thought that Montaigne was just, he respected his intellect, but thought he was, a villain intellectually. If you've ever read his essays, you can see why, you know, Pascal would think that.
On cannibalism?
Yeah. On cannibalism or on flatulence.
but keep in mind, Pascal himself was no slouch at satire. Yeah. If you've ever read the provincial letters where he takes on the Jesuits, and Voltaire actually said, you know, the Jesuits were disbanded in the late 18th century, largely for political reasons. Voltaire said that Pascal was connected to a group called the Jansenists who were centered at Port Royal Monastery outside of Paris. Voltaire said that the dissolution of the Jesuits was the revenge of Port Royal, and what he meant was Pascal.
Right. That's interesting that he would know enough of the history to be able to understand the sides.
Voltaire was brilliant. I mean, there's no question about that. He really knew what he was doing. He was very well informed, very well educated, and all of that. But partly because of his own temperament, I suspect, but also partly because of the way in which you got cultural cachet, he devoted almost all of his time, it seems, not really all of it, but a significant percent of his time in his literary pursuits to this kind of scathing denunciation of everything within France. And you know, you mentioned the church. I forgot who it was. It might have been Diderot. I'm not sure, but he said that society, the reform of society wouldn't be complete until the last king was strangled with the guts of the last priest.
Yeah, that's a charming thought. But the another one is, you know, he didn't like Rousseau very much either.
Oh, that's a mark in his favor. Rousseau spent most of his life trying to get Voltaire's approval. Voltaire spent all of his time in dealing with Rousseau basically labeling him a nut job.
And he was right.
Well, bringing up Rousseau, and I think my hunch back to the point I was making earlier about, you know, why would this strong emphasis on kind of this worldly health, right, and prolonging our life that came with some of these philosophical, philosophes, the flip side is the alternative is the embrace of that kind of aboriginal paradisal human that Rousseau was after. I mean, that notion of liberty unhindered by any mediating institution or tradition or anything else is very much alive and well in what I was talking about, kind of the sexual revolution and the undermining of any kind of continuance of a society to, you know, celebrate sexual identity at all costs.
So I've gone through three of mine. I'm going to give you the fourth now. And well, I would hope by this point that the observation is the conclusion of this would be obvious. We're in deep trouble, okay, as a culture, as a civilization. But the last one, and this is actually, you know, in terms of my own development, this is the first one that I noticed. Great powers are inevitably sunk by debt.
Right.
So when you look, for example, at the Spanish Empire was the first global empire. They had all the gold coming in from the New World. They controlled more of the landmass of the world than anybody else in history, even the Mongols, and it spanned oceans. And yet, in less than a century, they were bankrupt.
Right.
And the reason for this, there are several things involved in this, but part of the reason for it is that they, you know, the people sending gold from the New World didn't just do this out of the kindness of their heart. They expected things to return. You know, they expected manufactured goods, luxury items, things like that. And Spain didn't produce these. They had no economic infrastructure in place to produce these things. So the money came in and Spain basically became a pipeline to send gold and silver to the rest of Europe. To put this in perspective, when the Dutch revolted against Spain, Spain was so weak in terms of its manufacturing ability that they were buying arms from the Dutch, the people they were fighting. That tells you something about both the Dutch and the Spanish.
Okay. Yeah, we'll take that money. Yeah. We'll take that gold from you.
Yeah, and you know, and then they frittered it away in a lot of foreign wars and things like that. And the net result is Spain went bankrupt. And they became frankly, a political, cultural, and social backwater for centuries afterwards from being the greatest power in the world.
Right.
When you look at the French Revolution is as I said, you know, the people were primed for it, which we saw with their response to Voltaire. But the thing that triggers the French Revolution is a fiscal crisis, because the French government was severely in debt. They were actually in a debt spiral. They were consistently borrowing more and more money, both to service the debt and to continue high-end expenses. They got involved in a war, the American Revolution. They lost a war earlier. We call it the War of the French-Indian War. But they were seriously in debt. There was a gridlock where they couldn't pass new laws, new taxes, even approve loans, you know, borrowing to sustain the debt. And that's what's going to lead to the calling of the Estates General and ultimately the revolution. You can look at example after example. This is even true of the Roman Empire. They were in deep trouble financially as well. You can look at example after example of this, that great powers are sunk by debt, by out-of-control debt. And the results are rarely good. The best of them, I think, ends up being Spain. The worst of them is France or the Russian Revolution, which is also triggered in part, at least a big part, by a fiscal crisis.
Can you think, are you aware of any episode in which things reversed? I can maybe guess that at a small scale something could happen, but I'm not aware myself of anything on a really large scale like an empire.
Yeah, individual kingdoms have recovered from this, or nations have recovered from this kind of thing. But the larger the empire, the harder it is to recover from it, because the numbers are just so vast.
Right. I was thinking, you know, while you were talking about this, some of the things that may make our time different. I mean, of course, we can name a lot of them, but one of the things I think that is, you know, kind of troubling is the way, and, you know, we've talked about a lot about the dependency of culture now, our society, our culture on technology the way it is. We had a little AT&T outage last week on the phones. People didn't realize till the afternoon, knocked out communications. I couldn't communicate, you know, for over 10 hours through the normal means. I mean, something that small, and with us having complete inability to do anything about it. And if you have something, whether it's an outside attack or even an inside attack, anyone who wants to control things that can get a hold of any of this kind of stuff can shut down a society very quickly, and then couple that with a society who has not taught its people how to do anything, how to fish, how to take care of itself, how to make things, how to develop things. You're asking for, besides economic collapse and moral collapse, you're asking for a generation or two that completely have the incapacity to do anything.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, Tom. One of the things, though, I take a cold comfort in is that there's nobody that I look around at or I can identify as I look around at the various, you know, powers in the world who are in any better place. You know, we might think, well, what about the Chinese? But the Chinese are in a whole lot of trouble. So I don't really think of them as a genuine threat. And I mean, yeah, there are a lot of things that could do a lot of damage. I mean, there are nuclear weapons that are just all over the place. I can see why, you know, there could be a great deal of negative fallout in more than one way, if you get my drift, in the sense that, you know, there's just
some kind of grid collapse could do a lot of, you know, maybe short-term damage, but nevertheless, you don't think about the lasting effects when you have economies and business and everything so interconnected and dependent on those kind of things, and then being in such rigorous debt. It's not so hard to see things going south very quickly with that component added.
I was just thinking mostly in terms of becoming this sort of the servant of a foreign power. Yeah, I don't think that's going to be part of it. I think that there'd be a lot of chaos and a lot.
Yeah.
Now, and then the question is what could emerge out of that? You know, I think if you'd asked Romans whether or not they could imagine the center of sort of civilized life, sort of moving north to those territories that we described earlier with the Goths and the Vandals and so forth, they probably would have thought that is just too much of a stretch to even imagine. And yet, you know, 1,000 years later, is where, you know, where is the center of global power? It's in places like France and Germany and England and so forth.
I didn't do the exercise for here, but what I used to do when I was teaching this to my students, I used to calculate the number of seconds that how long, if you did a dollar a second, how long would it take you to pay off the national debt? And the numbers before it really started ballooning with Trump partly, but Biden has blown it even more. I mean, we're talking $2 trillion deficits now. The numbers were in the tens of thousands of years. I don't think people really, I mean, the number a trillion is not something that we can grasp conceptually. And yet we're, what, 34, 36 trillion in debt now, something like that. The U.S. cannot get out of debt. There is no way it is possible to get out of debt. And right now, service on debt is a greater percentage of federal income than defense is. And we've got a whole bunch of bonds that are maturing and are going to have to be rolled over, but they're going to have to be rolled over at what is now a higher interest rate, which means we're moving toward a debt spiral. Now, we aren't at a point where collapse is imminent. When 22% roughly of federal, of national, well, called federal income, the government's income, goes toward debt servicing, collapse is inevitable. We're 15-16% right now. So theoretically, it's possible to turn this around, but there's absolutely no will to do it. So well, when you take – yeah, excuse me. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. I think there is will, but it's not among the elites. It's among outliers. So if you think about what we've witnessed in Argentina, where – you know, you had inflation at a level that's hard for us to imagine in the United States. Finally, people were willing to just barely vote in a guy who was promising to do the drastic things that were needed to right the ship. But I suspect, I don't follow things closely there, but I suspect that he's got detractors, you know, even at this point, and they're probably getting more and more agitated with his successes, paradoxically.
Now, he's actually turned a really high level of deficit into a surplus.
Yeah, and that's pretty
impressive.
It's remarkable. But the thing about it is that the people who don't like him, they don't care. That's what you know. I think that's the kind of thing we're dealing with elites right now, is they're not willing to entertain the prospect that at a very fundamental level they're completely wrong and that they need to repent, literally in the sense of metanoia, learn to think again.
I've concluded that with a lot of our elites, it's more important to look like you're doing the right thing than to actually do it.
Right. Yeah, so. And that's the thing I'm concerned about is it's just that, you know, obviously for all of his faults, you know, we do have a presidential candidate who is promising drastic action. But even if he is elected again, we've already seen in his first administration that the administrative state will do everything it can to thwart his agenda.
I don't honestly think people really grasp the dangers of the kind of fiscal situation we're in. Now, you're right that, you know, China's in big trouble. They've got massive amounts of debt. The Chinese economic miracle was built around constructing infrastructure that was unneeded. I've been through China and been through empty cities that were put up, new buildings and all of that, that are just unoccupied. They've got a lot of debt. They've got a lot of useless holdings. And they're in a situation where a sort of reverse population bomb, an implosion in this case, is starting to take place even now. Russia is an important power in many ways, but they're not, they don't have the resources on a variety of levels, and they're also dealing with their own demographic crisis. I don't see them emerging here. I don't know who would be the next a power that could replace us, but what I do see is a very strong likelihood of Western civilization as we've known it collapsing. Every one of these four things that I've listed that are marks of civilizational collapse, I see operating in spades in the United States right now. Yeah. And for those of you out there who are postmodernists, this does not mean I believe the church is going to fail.
Yeah.
But
Postmillennialists.
Excuse me, not postmodernists, postmillennialists. Yeah.
Same Sorry, thing. No. I'm joking. I am joking. That was a joke. But a quick point on that is Western society that had, of course, taken the shape that it had in a certain kind of rejection of classic Christianity and an Enlightenment alternative, that has lost its heart for the Enlightenment. It, just on that very level, has lost its whole reason for being. And you can't just celebrate diversity without any content to that or direction or telos. And have a society sustain itself. I mean, just on that level, you can't. At least a society that had some kind of virtues or ethics that they were all aiming towards, their own glory or their own, you know, that could motivate people to at least rally around something. I think in Trump's case, he was trying to get a kind of nationalism back, right? Make, you know, return to a certain conception of when everyone was, you know, happy about being American, something like that. But with a rejection of that, both in, you know, large scale, not everyone, but a good, you know, the postmodern in particular, it's hard to imagine what kind of unified social vision beyond just, a kind of tagging of diversity and multiplicity and pluralism. Sustain itself.
We joke around sometimes about, you know, the Republic of Texas and its aspirations, or at least the aspirations of some of its citizens to break away. But you can have a situation where it just does break away because the country can't cohere. And, you know, they have access. Yeah, I think that a lot of the Midwest would go with them. They've got nuclear weapons. They've got access to the sea through the Gulf of Mexico. You know, I could see, you know, the southern states, a good part of the Midwest, Texas. And in that part of the country, you know, if people are familiar with that part of the country, you do have a much stronger coherence, yeah. Sort of cultural, you know, things do cohere culturally. Pretty well everywhere from Idaho down to Louisiana, you know. It's the coasts where, you know, you have the extreme wealth, but it's due to the fact that they have bought into a globalist program. But if the globalist program fails, then there's really not a whole lot in kind of the world as it currently is structured for, say, you know, that part of the country. I could see a new nation emerging out of the wreckage of the old.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one point I should probably have brought out is that with the Voltaire example, the radical self-critique, all you have to do is look at what critical theory says, critical race theory, but also colonial, post-colonial studies, what that has to say. And what you see is an argument that the United States is functionally illegitimate and is corrupt to its core. You know, and that is what is being promoted in universities and all the way down into elementary schools these days, in many public schools. Sure. So, you know, we've got that. We certainly got the deficit thing in spades. We're in our, I would argue, we may be past the third generation of the sexual revolution. And now we've got massive migration, whatever you want to call it. It's, you know, it's people just like the people who wanted to get into Rome for Roman benefits.
Oh, yeah.
Theoretically, they're trying to migrate into here to get America's benefits.
Yeah, it's the same
phenomenon.
And the
elites are corrupt and lazy, and they're doing exactly the same thing that the Romans did.
Yeah, and we're having a hard time sustaining our military, personnel. Mm-hmm. More and more people are disillusioned with military service.
Yeah, because the people who tend to go into military service tend to be conservatives, and you've got a government that hates conservatives and that is working to purge them from the military.
What that places the country in is in a position where it's either going to have to become much more mercenary in terms of its approach to recruiting, or it's going to have to, just as we saw with Rome, encourage immigration just for the standpoint of sustaining the military, which is a very unnerving prospect.
Right. Already been proposed, actually.
Yeah, I've heard that. So people moving to the United States immediately go into the military, help to strengthen the coercive power of the state, who have no long-term rootedness in the nation itself.
Yeah. And toward the late empire, the majority of the soldiers in the Roman legions were Germans.
Right.
Germanic peoples.
Right.
Same thing.
Yep.
So now one of the things that got me thinking about this, I mean, I've been thinking about all of these things for a while, frankly, but one of the things that made me think that this would be an interesting topic to bring up right now is our last episode with Annie Crawford. Because Annie similarly sees Western civilization as, well, I don't know if she'd quite put it this way, but doomed. She's expecting it to collapse. And what she's about is the question, what do you do about it? How do you prepare the next generations for picking up the pieces? Yeah. How do you get there? And she talks about it as the C.S. Lewis option, I think. I would describe it more as the Boethius option, but I think she'd agree with that one too.
Yeah.
Boethius is sometimes called the last Roman.
Yeah.
He was convicted of treason by a kangaroo court and was executed.
Yeah.
He wrote a number of really important things, one of them the Consolation of Philosophy, but he was also critical in helping to transmit ancient Roman education forward into the Middle Ages. He and Augustine are the two key people for preserving the liberal arts tradition that was then revived the Celtic areas by the Irish Church, ultimately. Yeah. What we need to be thinking about, you know, all of these dynamics I've talked about are things none of us can do anything about, as individuals. But what we need to be thinking about, first of all, is, I would argue, shoring up families where we are, developing pronatal policies where we are, if not officially in the government, then in our communities, really encouraging that on the one hand, but also rejecting and resisting the push for sexual license in the culture. And we need to recover the philosophy, the ideas, the core values, all of these things that shaped C.S. Lewis, but that were also foundational for Western civilization, so that if or when the collapse happens, we've got generations who are prepared to step up and rebuild and think what these things mean in their context.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on there, Glenn. Any thoughts, Tom, that you want to add?
Well, I think just to cap that off, that's really a lot of when we talk about the classic vision of transcendence of Christianity. It's all those things ordered to that high end, and I think that is that kind of retrieval. And for Lewis, that of course was the case. That kind of retrieval is a lot about what we're always talking about there here.
Yeah, I think there's a significant rift that has occurred in the evangelical world, but I think it's not just there. I see it in among Catholics and even Orthodox people. A group of people who more or less think that things are moving along just fine and that there's not much that we need to worry about. And they more or less take a steady as she goes, life just continues kind of approach. And then there are others who, like, you, Glenn, and others who have noted that we were in a bad spot. And we're kind of the Jeremiahs of the world, and we're thinking about not just the collapse of something, but what comes after, and trying to build lay some of the foundation stones for what comes next. You know, I think about a guy like Aaron Wren, our old friend, and his book, Life in Negative World, and just things that I see going on in my own little community here, where we're trying to organize our lives in such a way that we're going to be able to weather some challenges that we don't exactly know what those challenges will entail, but we do know that if we're going to weather them, it's because we're going to be working together and doing certain basic things. One of those things being having kids, because it's not something that we're not talking about weathering a challenge that, is just a season of life, but we're talking about something on a far greater scale. And in order to do that, we have to have an intergenerational mindset. So like at my church in the fall, we're going to be sponsoring a conference entitled The Pronatal Church. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a pronatal church? To actually encourage people to have kids and think about kids as a blessing rather than just see ourselves as sort of a chaplain that walks alongside people who want to live for their best lives now and get the best, most money they can and pursue their career dreams, which right. seems to be what much of evangelicalism has been reduced to. But we're going to have Scott Yenner and Alan Carlson out here that conference. It's going to be great. Anyway, why don't we wrap it up with that? And thank you for listening to another episode of the Theology Podcast. I said another as though you have been a longtime listener, but maybe this is your first time listening to an episode. And if either way, we would like you to know about a couple of things. One is our Patreon account, which is a really important part of the sort of Theology Podcast team, because they pay the bills. And we're really grateful for those folks because of their monthly gifts. And if you'd like to become one of them, there's a link in the show notes for that. And then we're getting ready to go to the United Kingdom. We're excited about that, going to Oxford. And we do have our Indiegogo page up. And now, we mentioned a few episodes back that we were going to have it up, and we didn't get it up before that episode was posted. But by the time this episode posts, it will definitely be up, because we're in like the last steps of getting everything wrapped up to get that launched. So anyway, if you'd like to learn about that and learn about how you can support us with that effort, please follow the link in the show notes. Anyway, that's enough for now. Thanks a lot, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
The Theology Podcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. To learn more about the church, you can visit trinityreformedkirk.com. trinityreformedkirk.com.